This week on the Best of Flashpoints, another innocent man is murdered by the state of Texas. We'll hear from Reginald Blanton's mother, uncle, and anti-death penalty experts. Also, over 150 dead in Baghdad. We'll speak with Ahmed Habib of Al Jazeera about the continuing despair in U.S.-occupied Iraq, and women's rights leader Zoya of the Revolutionary Association of Women in Afghanistan debunks the myth that more troops and an entrenched U.S. occupation will save the Afghan women. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Of course, we are flying by the seat of our pants because we did want to cover this murder that just took place in Texas after another murder of an innocent man who has been shown to be innocent, Todd Willingham. The state of Texas shows no mercy whatsoever for Reginald Blanton. We're going to hear a lot more about that. But first, we're going to hear the Knight Report from New York City with Robert Knight.
In today's Knight Report, the Islamic State of Iraq claims responsibility for Sunday's massive Baghdad bombings, and a gung-ho warrior diplomat resigns over the Afghan war. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Responsibility for Sunday's dual truck bomb attacks on Iraq's justice and Baghdad ministries was claimed today by a group with links to al-Qaeda in Iraq. In an internet statement, the Islamic State of Iraq claimed that its agents, quote, targeted the dens of infidelity, including the Ministry of Injustice and Oppression, end quote. Sunday's attacks killed more than 160 and wounded five times as many, and in conjunction with similar attacks in August, have severely hampered not only the Justice Department, but also the Ministries of Foreign Affairs, Finance, Municipalities, and Public Works. Late today, Baghdad's Governor Salah Abdul Razak called for the firing of the occupation regime's Minister of the Interior, whom he blamed for alleged negligence that allowed the bombings. The attacks appear to be aimed at destabilizing the Shia supremacist administration of the U.S.-installed Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He faces an election challenge that may or may not take place in January, but that date has yet to be confirmed by the occupation parliament, which is politically fractured between Shia and Sunni and stymied over the issue of a partitioning from Baghdad of Iraq's oil-producing northern region of Kurdistan. The election was to have been officially confirmed 2 weeks ago under the U.S.-imposed constitution, but last-minute meetings continue today with few indications of agreement. And in Afghanistan today, the Obama administration met a new milestone with this week's deaths of 22 more troops in various bomb attacks and helicopter crashes. The deaths brought October's American death toll in Afghanistan to at least 55, even more than the 51 who died during the turmoil of the tainted presidential election of August. Americans account for 900 of the 1,500 foreign troops killed so far in Afghanistan. A second runoff is scheduled for November 7th, and there were political maneuvers today in Kabul, where the U.S.-installed President Hamid Karzai refused to fire the head of his election commission, as demanded by leading challenger Abdul Abdullah. Abdullah hinted that if the commissioner is not fired by the end of the month, he may drop out of the election, whose first round was marked by widespread fraud, most of it on behalf of Karzai. And finally, the Obama administration's diplomatic front in Afghanistan is beginning to show the same strain as the war front. A key State Department official covering Afghanistan resigned loudly today after a six-month stint, saying the occupation is not working. Foreign Service Officer Matthew Ho is the first official publicly known to have quit in protest of the war. In his resignation letter, Ho said, quote, I have lost understanding of and confidence in the strategic purposes of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. My resignation is based not upon how we are pursuing this war, but why and to what end, end quote. Ho said that Afghans resent the presence of U.S. troops and are fighting to drive them out from a sense of patriotism or nationalism rather than for ideological reasons. But the gung-ho former Marine veteran of the war in Iraq also advocated extrajudicial deprivation of life by U.S. occupation forces abroad. According to the Washington Post, Ho also said, and here we quote, there are plenty of dudes who need to be killed. I was never more happy than when our Iraq team whacked a bunch of guys, end quote, former diplomat Matthew Ho. And that's some of the news of this Tuesday, October 27, 2009. In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we continue our coverage of the United States and the state of Texas decision to continue to murder people. And we have seen now in so many cases innocent people being taken off at the last minute. But a few minutes before, after 6 o'clock local time, Texas time at the Huntsville prison, the state of Texas did in fact murder Reginald Blanton. We're going to hear later on in this broadcast a very troubling plea, last minute plea from his mom. We're going to speak with his uncle who just spoke with him before he was murdered, and we began our series of interviews at the gates of the Huntsville prison with Gloria Rebeck, a longtime activist against the death penalty.
We are out here to protest this legal lynching of Reginald Blanton. We send our love and solidarity to Andre and Sandy and everybody that's witnessing this murder by the state of Texas. And that's what it is, a murder. And as Reggie's mom says, it's a legal lynching. The state of Texas has executed over 440 people, and dozens of them have been innocent. And tonight, they're making another mistake by putting to death Reginald Blanton.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We go to really the heart of Texas, to a situation where another execution is about to happen. We have just learned that all appeals have been turned down in the case of Reginald Blanton, another case in which many people feel there may be the execution of an innocent man, but many, many more people feel that killing anybody by the state is wrong. Joining us at the walls of the prison is an old friend, Gloria Rebeck. Tell us, Gloria, exactly where you are, name of the prison, and what the scene is outside now.
I'm at what's called as the Walls Unit, because it's got a huge red brick wall around it. In the center of Huntsville, Texas, I'm standing outside a yellow crime scene tape, which is blocking off the street where the front doors of the prison are. And I guess in a 10 or 15 minutes, the execution will begin. I just spoke to Reginald's uncle, who is also named Reginald, and he told me that everything had been filed and turned down. And that's it as far as the legal options.
Now, are there people there protesting? Are there signs? What's the mood outside the walls? Are people particularly troubled given that they're still raw from the execution of Todd Willingham, who has been apparently shown to be another innocent man murdered in Texas?
Yeah, actually the mood is a little somber because it's just hard to believe that the state would continue to carry out executions when Todd Willingham has been on, you know, CNN and in every newspaper around the country. You know, the system's broken. It doesn't work. And Todd Willingham, I wish he was the only innocent person executed, but he hasn't been. So people are out here. Reginald's uncle, is that his cousin? A sister-in-law. A number of his family members are out here. His brother is going to witness the execution, and his girlfriend, and I think one more person. His mom couldn't even bring herself to be in Huntsville.
Are they inside now preparing for the execution?
The witnesses are inside, and the situation here is that there's a prison administration building right across this blocked-off street from the Walls Unit, and at 6 o'clock, the media will walk across the street. And then following the media will be the witnesses. The victims' witnesses are always already in there. They must go in there. I don't know what time. We never see them. So
Reginald's family is talking to media and talking to protesters. There's a number of signs. One of the things that Reginald's mother has emphasized, that this is a legal lynching that they want to carry out. So there's several signs here with Shaka's photo and Momia's photo on them, and it says no more, they say no more legal lynchings. There's also a poster on a stick with Todd Willingham's picture and Governor Rick Perry's picture. And above Rick Perry, it says guilty, and above Todd Willingham, it says innocent, and it says abolition now. So there's over a dozen people, I guess, here. And then I just got a phone call from Austin, and actually Reginald's mother, bless her heart, has joined the protest in Austin at the state capitol.
Yeah, we just spoke to the people over there, and she is protesting, but she's not anxiously talking to the public anymore. She is bracing for the worst. That's our information there. I know that you're in Huntsville, Texas. We should tell people we're talking about 6 o'clock Texas time. You're 2 hours ahead of us, where we're talking to you from Berkeley, California. And again, I should let people know that the state is getting ready on the edge of murdering another person, Reginald Blanton, in Texas, which is the sort of murder capital. I guess it is the murder capital of the U.S. and perhaps the world. And I guess what they're gonna use a lethal injection. Is that it?
Yeah, this will be the 442nd time they've used the lethal injection here in the last 15 years.
And I know that you oppose the death penalty no matter what, and you feel it needs to be abolished. But in terms of actually people being innocent of the crimes, is there a pattern now that poor people of color are, in fact, their due process is undermined, and there has been a pattern of killing innocent people?
Well, I don't know if there's a pattern, because everybody on death row is poor. 9 out of 10 of them had a court-appointed lawyer. And the majority are people of color, 70%. So that's who's on death row. I don't know about a pattern, but I think that with the Willingham case, what we're seeing in Texas is that people are saying, wow, maybe Shaka Sankofa was innocent, or maybe Francis Newton was innocent, or maybe, because, I mean, there's dozens of innocent people. Out of 440 some odd executions, there's dozens and dozens that have been innocent. I mean, if you just look at all the exonerees that are coming out now, that particularly out of Dallas, because of DNA testing of just not death row prisoners, but general population, you figure that, you know, you've got to have the same percentage on death row. People make mistakes. They make mistakes, and then also from the cops to the courts to the DAs to the judges, things are pretty much stacked against you if you don't have money. Minister Robert Muhammad spoke at our annual rally Saturday, and he ended by saying, you know, it's better to be guilty and rich in Texas than it is to be poor and innocent. And that is so true.
Let me ask you this, Gloria. You said that Reginald's uncle, Reginald, is there.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that we might be able to get a word with him from there in Huntsville?
I can ask him. Let me walk over here. He's talking to a crowd of people.
And you can continue to talk to us and describe the scene, please.
Well, there's actually, it looks like, three, maybe, counter-protesters here. Mr. Reginald, I'm talking to a very friendly radio station in Berkeley, California. Are you up to talking to anybody? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Dennis, just a moment. This is Reginald's uncle, just a moment.
Hello.
Hello, thanks for being with us at this very terrible time. You are the uncle of Reginald Blanton. What's going through your mind now? Tell us what you're thinking about.
I'm very sad. I'm very disappointed. I just spoke to Reginald about 20 minutes ago, up until about 2 minutes before 5 o'clock, and I'll tell you, He's not the man that they convicted for the crime. He's basically just a scholar. And we're going to lose a very good person. We don't know how we're going to recover from this, but we're going to shout to the Lord and let everybody know that this is a good man, and he paid his time, and he's on his way to the Lord, and we just wish it didn't have to come to this.
Well, tell us a little bit about the things that he said to you and his state of mind, if you could.
Well, I've been reading a lot of Reginald's writings. He writes very clear and very compassionately, and he's very happy and thankful to everybody who has struggled and worked toward his freedom. And it's just the system is not allowing it to happen. And if we would put the due diligence into trying to find the innocents instead of just being so quick to do what we're doing here in Texas, we're just very sad and disappointed and sorry. And I want to thank all of the people that are here to abolish this death penalty, because it's destroying even more than it's bringing.
Is Reginald angry?
No. Let me say this. I will say this. He is very, he's at a place of peace to where he has accepted that this is an injustice he can't do anything about. But he made me smile with the strength and fortitude that he's showing. And I'm very proud to be here.
And what can you tell us about your nephew that's important to you, qualities that you want the world to know?
The qualities are that he made himself better since that crime that he was convicted for. He is a much better person, and I'd rather walk with him, right next to him, than a lot of the people that are free and doing things that have no conscience about him, because he's a very, very humble man right now. And we're losing a good person.
All right. We've been speaking with the uncle of Reginald Blanton. Reginald Blanton is facing state-sponsored murder now in Huntsville, Texas. And the uncle, Reginald, is right outside those gates. We do send our sympathy. We wish you the best. And if there's some last-minute miracle, we will hope for that with you, because, of course, all murder is wrong.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you just for listening and letting people be able to just say what they feel. And I thank you so much. These people are out here spending their time and their effort, and I can't thank them enough. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Could you put Gloria back on, please?
Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Gloria. Thank you so much. Very important for people in the rest of the country to hear what's going on, to hear the suffering that the state can cause. I guess no word yet. It has, I guess...
Not yet. We'll know in a couple of minutes if the media walks across the street that it's going to happen. And, you know, the thing that Reginald was saying about his nephew is so true. He's a leader of a group on death row called the DRIVE Movement. And DRIVE stands for Death Row, Intercommunal Vanguard Engagement. And these are men on the road that have fought for years to better the conditions. They've held hunger strikes and civil disobedience type things on the row.
We're going to cut that there because we do, in fact, have Gloria back live with us. And of course, we know that there was another murder that took place in Huntsville. You want to tell us about, you were there, Gloria Rubeck? Tell us about the mood there in front of the prison and what you can tell us about this murder.
It's a very, another sad day here in Texas and in Huntsville. I just left the funeral home. Reggie's family is in the funeral home with him, telling him goodbye. And touching him for the first time in over a decade while his body is still warm. You would think that because Texas has so many executions, that those of us who are involved in the abolition movement here would be used to this, but you don't ever get used to it. Every person that's executed has a story. It's not, no case is simple, but also every person that's executed has a family, and it's very hard talking to the family and watching them go through the pain and suffering that Reggie's family went through.
We know that there wasn't much hope here, and yet you, Gloria, continue to go to the gates of that death house in Huntsville. What drives you on this?
Well, what drives me, I guess originally what drove me was that I just thought it was wrong. What's driving me now is that finally I'm starting to feel a little wind at our back with the case of Todd Willingham that's gotten so much publicity. And just the fact that attitudes even in Texas are changing, I feel like we're on the road to abolition. It might still be a while, but I do feel a little bit of wind at our backs. And the other thing that keeps me going is in 1993, I witnessed a dear friend of mine's execution. And as he was laying on the gurney with an IV in his arm, he told me, "Whatever you do, Gloria, promise me that you're going to keep up the fight." And I promised him, so.
And that would be Shaka Sinkova.
No. This was in 1993. This man's name was Carlos Santana. He was a young man from the Dominican Republic.
All right. Well, listen, Gloria, we're not going to hold you on. We're going to get a few more details from Carter Pagel, but we thank you for standing there at the gates of the Huntsville prison, knowing that there wasn't much hope, and yet you wanted to call attention to this this death mill in Texas, where we have already seen a number of instances where innocent men and women were either killed or saved at the last moment. Thank you for being with us. Please take care.
Okay, thank you, and I really appreciate Flashpoint's covering this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and we're going to continue the coverage with Carter Pagel. He works with the campaign to end the death penalty. Carter Pagel, I know that you were in a different location than the prison, and you were near to Reginald's mom. You want to tell a little bit about what it was like there as she learned about this murder of her son by the state of Texas?
Yeah, we were... We were outside the capital of Texas, about 50 of us protesting this execution, and Reginald's mother and some of his other relatives were there, and it was, you know, as you can imagine, it was heartbreaking. She broke down, and she was even at one point, I mean, this is a little graphic, but I mean, it made her sick, physically ill, like she was vomiting, and it was just, you know, I mean, I can't even imagine what that must be like, but yeah, it was heart-wrenching for anyone to see that. I don't know how you can see that.
She was pretty courageous protesting there to the end, huh?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, she's been speaking out, you know, we've had rallies in San Antonio, her hometown, in Austin, and then we had a march this past weekend, which I'm sure maybe Gloria mentioned she was there, a march to abolish the death penalty here in Austin, and Reginald's mother, Anna Terrell, was there speaking out, and very courageous to go. I mean, she was, I guess, visiting her son this morning and then drove to Austin to protest with us. So
tell us a little bit more about the man that was murdered by the state of Texas just a little bit ago.
Well, you know, he was a man who never stopped fighting and never was going to stop fighting. A brave, you know, in the face of death, and telling, you know, giving strength to others. There was a, you know, his fellow inmates on death row and in the prison are participating in a hunger strike right now in protest of his execution. That's the kind of impact that he has on the people around him. And he was the kind of person also who was up until the end fighting for other people to free them, you know, not, and he was a self-taught law student, he actually filed some of his own appeals because, as you I'm sure know, I mean, when you're poor, you get not the greatest representation, and his appeals attorney was ignoring his request to file certain things, so he went and did it on his own, and then he filed a grievance with the state bar. Just a, you know, I mean, it's a real shame that we would lose someone like that.
And you say there's a hunger strike going on now in the prison at Huntsville. And when's the last time you saw Reginald?
Well, I've not actually seen him. I worked on the case. I've not visited him. Someone, a member of our group, Randy Jones, was his pen pal and visited with him. So.
And how is he doing in these last days?
You know, I mean, I don't want to speak for them, but I mean, they and his mother, I mean, I talked to her and, you know, they said that he was giving them strength because of the way he was handling it, you know, just like I said, a fighter up until the end. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say, you know, I mean, I don't know. And
tell us about, I guess there, it's particularly raw in Texas these days, given the fact that there was just the state-sponsored murder of Tard Willingham, where there is rather compelling evidence that not only the state killed an innocent man, but that there may have been a cover-up to make sure it happened. Could you sort of put this into that context?
Definitely. Yeah, so the story of Tard Willingham is one that, you know, we've put a lot of focus on because we think it's a chance. I mean, it's not the first time that Texas or the United States has executed an innocent person, we don't believe, but it's maybe one of the first times we have real proof. And so he was executed in 2004 for allegedly setting a fire that killed his three children. Right before the execution, a independent fire scientist named Gerald Hurst had issued an affidavit and a statement to Governor Rick Perry that there were a lot of signs pointing to the fact that this fire was not arson, that the science that the investigators used in the original trial was, you know, faulty, was based on old information or old learnings, not the modern fire science that he knew. So Rick Perry had this information, refused to look at it, basically, and he also has refused to release the documents saying how they handled that information. When they got the affidavit, what did he do? Did he read it? Did he do anything? We don't know. He ignored it and went ahead with the execution, and now it's really coming back to haunt him because now there's the Forensic Science Commission in the state of Texas hired another fire investigator to look into this, and his investigation is even more definitive, saying no basis for arson in this case. That they've done, you know, tests that show that this is how an accidental fire would have behaved. So, and then, as you mentioned, the cover up. Days before this fire scientist was scheduled to present his findings to the commission, Perry removed three of the members on the commission, and
the governor did that.
Yes, sorry, Rick Perry, the governor of the state of Texas, removed three members on this commission and replaced the head of the commission with a very conservative DA from the conservative Williamson County, and he promptly canceled the meeting with the fire scientist. So, you know, who knows when the truth will come out. I mean, it's come out to people who who have read the fabulous article in The New Yorker by David Grand, which detailed everything about the case, but when it's going to come out to the state of Texas and when they're going to actually admit that they executed an innocent man in the Cameron Tard Willingham case, we don't know.
Well,
and I guess
go on, please.
Yeah, sure. To put it in perspective, you know, with Reginald Blanton, this is another man who had very strong innocence claim. There was no physical evidence linking him to the crime scene.
Talk about that.
Yeah. I've worked extensively, you know, studying this case and worked with a member of the Texas Defender Service, and he was, you know, invaluable in getting me court records and things like this. And I've looked at this case, and there was no physical evidence. There was no DNA, no fingerprints, no eyewitnesses even, and no murder weapon found. The only thing that they had originally was they brought in Reginald's twin brother's girlfriend on some domestic abuse things, and she had some other outstanding warrants. They brought her in, got a statement from her saying that Reginald had bragged about killing this man, Carlos Garza. Later in the trial, in sworn testimony, she recanted that and said she was coerced. She was threatened with being charged with capital murder if she didn't point the finger at Reginald. So, I mean, they had nothing really. I mean, I think that in this case, the signs really, you know, pointed to the fact that he was innocent. He maintained that all along. And like I said, nothing, at least there was reasonable doubt because no physical evidence linked him to this crime. And on top of that, there was a case of something that they do in Texas, which is absurd, but they have this thing called a jury shuffle, which means the attorneys look at the jury pool, they can look at just their physical appearance and request a shuffle, meaning if they think, you know, in this case, Reginald's a young African-American male, if they think that, you know, the prosecutor doesn't want African-Americans on his jury, they see him in the front, which is exactly what happened. They saw a handful of African-Americans in the front of the jury. She requested, this is the DA, Tamara Butler, in Bexar County. She requested a jury shuffle, moved the African-Americans to the back. There were none in the top 63 jurors questioned for duty. And then when they actually made it to some of the black people, she used peremptory strikes to strike them. So Reginald was judged by an all-white jury. This is a young African-American male judged by an all-white jury, hardly a jury of his peers. And as I said before, a poor young African-American male who couldn't afford good defense. And they didn't bring up a lot of the facts in the case. They didn't let him testify. There was a shoe print on the door of the victim, which was, you know, two sizes larger than the shoe size Reginald wears. They didn't bring that up in the trial. So, I mean, it's really a travesty. And I think that Governor Perry really made a big mistake by not halting this execution. And I think that even the Supreme Court made a mistake by not looking at the racial discrimination in this case. There is a precedent for that. There's a case called Miller L, which is in Dallas County, where they said this jury shuffle thing to systematically exclude African-Americans from the jury is racial discrimination and won't stand. And they, you know, they ignored it in this case. And I think it'll come back just like the Cameron Todd Willingham case is coming back to haunt Governor Perry. I think this one will too, because we really strongly believe that Reginald was innocent.
If you had a couple of minutes with Governor Perry now, what would you want to tell him?
Well, I would want to tell him that Reginald was, you know, I mean, he's someone's son. He's, oh God, that's a good question. I would want to tell him so many things. First of all, I would want to make him feel the real emotion and let him know how Reginald's mother felt in those last few minutes and for the whole 9 years, you know, when he was on death row, knowing that her son was going to die and fighting, but being scared. I would want to make him feel that and ask him how that would feel if that was his child. And I would also want to tell him, because he hides a lot behind, and he's done this in the Cameron Todd Willingham case too, hiding behind, well, the courts found him guilty, saying the courts found him guilty and there were a lot of appeals. That doesn't always work, you know? I mean, there are countless cases of people that were found guilty and later proved innocent. I just met a man this past weekend named Curtis McCarty. He served 19 years on death row. He had three separate trials in which he was found guilty, yet 19 years later, DNA evidence proved he was innocent. And that was only because the FBI came and investigated the forensic scientist who was in charge of his case and a bunch of other cases, because she was forging documents and perjuring herself on the stand. So the system is completely broken. I would want to tell him that you can't hide behind the fact that these people were found guilty in a court of law. It's not good enough. You know, you need to look. It needs to be looked closer at. And that's why we strongly believe the death penalty should be abolished. When I say we, I mean the campaign and the death penalty, because there is no definitive answer. There's obviously no proving anything. If 138 people can be sentenced to die on death row, and that's how many it's been, 138 since 1973, if they can be sentenced to die and then later exonerated, then we know we're going to be putting innocent people to death. And that is not acceptable in a country that claims to be, you know, a leader in human rights and freedom.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We return to the deteriorating situation in U.S.-occupied Iraq. More than 150 people died and over 500 were wounded in twin car bomb attacks near the massive so-called Green Zone Occupation Administration compound in central Baghdad yesterday. According to Al Jazeera, the attacks targeted the Justice Ministry and the headquarters of the Baghdad Provincial Administration close to the Tigris River. Jalal Talabani, the U.S.-backed Iraqi president, said, quote, "The perpetrators of these treacherous and despicable acts are no longer hiding their objective, but to the contrary, they publicly declare that they are targeting the state and aiming at blocking the political process, halting it, and destroying what we have achieved in the last 6 years." U.S. President Barack Obama, meanwhile, said the bombs showed the attackers, quote, "hateful and destructive agenda," adding, quote, "I strongly condemn those outrageous attacks on the Iraqi people and send my deepest condolences to those who have lost loved ones. These bombings serve no purpose other than the murder of innocent men, women, and children, and they only reveal the hateful and destructive agenda of those who would deny the Iraqi people the future that they deserve." Joining us to talk about the attacks yesterday and the future that the Iraqi people deserve is our special correspondent, Ahmed Habib. Ahmed is a reporter with Al Jazeera English and is a spoken word poet. He joins us from Doha. Ahmed, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me, Nora.
So let's talk about the situation in Baghdad right now, the day after these twin car bomb explosions that killed so many people, and what this signifies in terms of Obama's relentless pursuit of continuing this lethal U.S. occupation and colonial project in Iraq.
I think it's just another horrific reminder of how things are heading in Iraq. It's really upsetting for the people of Iraq to hear Obama show a lot of disgust about the bombings that have taken place when he hasn't shown disgust about creating the conditions that unleashed the latest attack on the ground in Iraq. 150 people might have died, but thousands of lives were destroyed. Thousands of lives were affected by the bombings. Mothers were burying their sons. Those aren't people that are part of the statistical accounts of what happened in Baghdad. And I think that more and more people in Iraq are realizing that the Iraqi government that's in place right now is completely unfit to rule the government, not only from a perspective where they have the interests of the Iraqi people in place, but completely unable to run the government in the most basic understanding of what a government should be responsible for. Education, we're seeing a tremendous amount of teachers that have either been killed or kidnapped or have left the country. The healthcare system is in shambles. There is absolutely no provision of the basic necessities for life. And of course, security in a country where insecurity is very much a part of the agenda is also at play. The Iraqi government, of course, one of the favorite things they have to do is not take responsibility for anything that goes on in the country. Jalal Talabani, as you mentioned in your introduction, wants to pretend that the situation in Iraq, the political process in Iraq, rather, is being halted by these horrific bombings. But yet, the reality of the matter is, to this day, the Iraqi parliament has not agreed on an election law, and elections look much like they did in Afghanistan, like they're going to be the victim of occupation politics that will definitely be destined for the trash can of history, much like they are under any kind of occupation. We see much more in Iraq, the situation increasing, where there is an absolute lack of accountability for what's taking place. So much like the apartheid system in Israel, where the Palestinian Authority has contracted out the dirty work of the Israeli occupation, the same thing is happening in Iraq, where the Iraqi government is carrying out the work of conducting an occupation in Iraq. We saw recently that the Iraqi government has awarded oil companies from China and from other parts in the world access to oil resources, and that's the only thing that they're able to really conduct effectively is selling off the country's natural resources. We haven't seen anything on the ground in terms of improvement in the conditions of people that are living there. I know that many reporters and journalists try to pretend that the situation in Iraq is getting better, and perhaps they are accurate in the sense that it is getting better in terms of how it relates to how the situation transpired 6 years ago. But the reality of the matter is that Iraqis are dying in an increasing number, is that the natural resources of the country are being siphoned off at a faster rate, and that the future of Iraq is really being thrown under the boots of American soldiers and is being wasted away like the bullets that are being fired into the bodies of innocent people. So I think that President Obama, when he addresses the American people and addresses our listeners and speaks of how he wants to see an end to the situation in Iraq, I think people have to be vigilant, and remind President Obama that the only effective way to empower the people of Iraq is to end the current occupation and to also start looking at an active system of reparations that's going to put Iraq back into a situation where it can be governed by its own people.
That's the voice of Ahmed Habib speaking to us from Doha. And it wasn't just Obama that expressed his so-called concern. Also, Hillary Clinton was in the mix as well. She said, quote, "These despicable attacks seek to undermine the impressive progress that Iraq has made towards stability and self-reliance." What reality is she talking from? What's your response to this heavy rebranding campaign by the Obama administration to soften the image of the U.S. occupation and its disaster policies on the ground?
Well, it seems that the rebranding campaign that's being put forward by the Obama administration only has weight in the American mainstream media. For people in Iraq, it's very much reminiscent of old colonialism. Hillary Clinton lands in a military plane, is greeted by American military personnel and the American diplomatic mission. She goes to the country uninvited. She either makes time to meet with Iraqi government officials or doesn't make time to meet with Iraqi government officials. President Obama, of course, rediverting attention and rediverting troops from Iraq to our sisters and brothers in Afghanistan. And we see that the American war of terror is expanding now into Pakistan as well. And we understand that the situation in Iraq, in fact, can only be solved with a holistic approach and a holistic resistance to the American project for an empire throughout the world, and in particular in areas that are close to Iraq. For Iraqis, when you ask them about the rebranding of the American occupation, they'll quickly point you to their empty, broken-down fridge with no power to it, or they'll point you to the pictures of loved ones who have been killed in the last 6 years, or they'll take you down to a walk to the hospital where perhaps the stench of conditions in that hospital will be unbearable to most American reporters. Our listeners should remember the majority of the rebranding campaign and the way it's being received in the American media is done within the confines of the green zone, where there's a, there's a Burger King and there's a nightclub that's called Camp Freedom or something to that effect. There's a clear dichotomy between the reality on the ground in Iraq and what the Obama administration is very actively trying to do. And of course, we can't take the blame off the Iraqi government, which has been very complicit in this rebranding campaign. It's also in their service to move forward towards operating within a discourse that tries to pretend that everything in Iraq is heading in the right direction. But I assure you, Nora, and I assure our listeners that the situation in Iraq is not only getting worse, but is in fact completely heading in the direction where there might unfortunately be a point of no return. In a country that is so bountiful with resources, whether they be human resources and natural resources, to have the kind of living conditions that we have in that country is a crime on its own. The American administration, of course, pays the same kind of lip service to the so-called peace process between apartheid Israel and the Palestinian Authority, who, of course, have the same interests like the Iraqi government to pretend that they are part and parcel of the decision-making process, when we very well know that in Iraq, the real government is the American embassy that houses more than several ministries in Iraq in terms of employees. And we know that the real decision-makers in Iraq are the multinational companies that are flopping at the mouth to go in there and try to siphon off the resources as quick as possible. So the rebranding campaign might have some kind of repercussions in the eyes of morning news shows in the United States or even mainstream media throughout the world, but any report that we're getting from on the ground and any of the horrific images that we've been seeing lately from the two car bombings that we've seen in Iraq really sends you a different picture. وتكتر علي يا نواحي وتكتر علي انواحي
صبري. In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Al Jazeera is reporting that at least 14 American occupation soldiers have been killed and more than 25 Afghans and Americans injured in two alleged military helicopter crashes in Afghanistan. NATO is denying that the helicopters could have been shot down by anti-occupation resistance groups. Meanwhile, the Obama administration is planning to send tens of thousands more U.S. troops to the country as top officials reiterate their brand of logic, saying that the troops will enforce a humanitarian mission instead of one of entrenched lethal occupation. Joining us to talk about the reality of today's Afghanistan is Zoya. Zoya is the author of Zoya's Story, An Afghan Woman's Struggle for Freedom with John Fullian and Rita Christofari. She is a second-generation member of the radical underground group RAWA, or Revolutionary Association for Women in Afghanistan. Zoya is touring the country, speaking out against the ongoing U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and the threat of fundamentalism posed by the Taliban. In a message to Obama and Congress, she said, quote, "Liberation can only come from within. End the U.S. occupation." Zoya, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk about the current crisis right now inside your country. After a period of questionable elections, to say the least, Obama's insistence on sending perhaps up to 80,000 more troops to occupy your country, and a total unraveling of the social fabric, the security and humanitarian situations, what can you say about the reality of today's Afghanistan that we're not hearing about if you just watch the news or listen to the corporate media?
Yeah, if we say that in the past 8 years by thousands of troops present in Afghanistan and with so much money which is poured in the country and with about 42 foreign countries present in Afghanistan, we see that this occupation and this war had no positive outcome for people. It was not possible, as we always say, that waging war does not bring liberation. Because I think 8 years was quite enough time. Also, the history of the world showed this. The history of Afghanistan showed that democracy should come from the inside, from the democratic forces, and from the by the people of Afghanistan. And today we see that Karzai government, with the help of, as I said, thousands of troops and occupiers, they failed to bring peace and security in Afghanistan, to bring democracy. At the recent election, as one of the main signs of democracy, I think was quite enough proof of the fact that we do not enjoy democracy under occupation. We don't have democracy at all. This was, I think, even United Nations, European Community, and international media was speaking how fraudulent the election was, about the widespread fraud in the election, intimidation of voters, stuffing the ballot boxes, so-called the mystery of invisible voters. So even the international media spoke about it. And RAWA is organized as a political organization, as a democratic organization. From the very beginning, we condemned the elections because we predicted that a country which is ruled by fundamentalism and terrorism and drug lords and warlords and war criminals, how possibly in that country we can have a fair and free election. So that's the reason that today we see that from one side, the first candidate is Karzai, which already proved in the past 8 years that he, by compromising with the warlords, by appointing the war criminals in the key positions of the government, and also by, kind of strong and very close relationship that he had with the warlords, unfortunately, he failed. He betrayed to the trust of people. He betrayed to democracy. And from the other side, we have Abdullah Abdullah, who's a very famous commander of Northern Alliance groups. He was the foreign minister. And he is one of the responsible for massacre of people, for killing of people, for killing the intellectuals of Afghanistan, the democratic leaders of Afghanistan, the innocent civilians in the time from 92 till 94 when Northern Alliance groups dominated Afghanistan. And today we see that another choice, unfortunately, is Abdullah Abdullah. So both of them are like, choosing between two evils. So that's why RAWA condemned this election. We consider that a drama, a kind of very dirty game, which is being played with the destiny of our people. And it cannot be considered as a democratic election.
That's the voice of Zoya. She's with the Revolutionary Association for Women in Afghanistan, and she's touring the country. And let's talk about the role of women and the context in which women are being used to further this occupation by the United States. Essentially, you know, women are being used as a currency to say that we can't possibly leave Afghanistan because then we would be putting the women in harm's way. What is really going on behind this logic, this rhetoric that has been used in every single foreign occupation of your country and others? Can you talk about this?
I think that women's liberation and women's rights was one of the main reasons, one of the main justification for United States to occupy Afghanistan. And they had used it as a very good reason in front of the international, you know, the people of America particularly, and also international community to invade Afghanistan. We see that today, after 8 years of war and occupation, Afghanistan women, particularly if we talk about the 95% of the poor women in majority of the provinces and the villages and the rural areas of Afghanistan, they are not enjoying freedom or democracy, but their life is more or less same as the time of the Taliban, as they are facing domestic violence in a very horrible way because there is no government, there is no law, there is no implementation of law. There's no protection of women, and we see that inside the parliament, because majority of the members of parliament are Northern Alliance groups, are, you know, these fundamentalist commanders and anti-women, anti-democratic individuals are legislating for Afghan people. Unfortunately, today, they are making these very horrible laws against Shia women, that they allow rape within marriage, and they give some kind of, they allow punishment of their women, even to starving, you know, to not give them food if they are not accepting sexual violence of their husbands. So how we can expect from warlords and terrorists and fundamentalist groups to make laws which protect the women? And if we see today, from one side, domestic violence, from the other side, every second they are in fear of being kidnapped, killed, gang raped, forced to marry the powerful gunmen and drug lords, to put acid on their faces, even they cannot go to attend a school. Although we have today, this is also used as a justification to say that the doors of schools are open, so it means that women have liberation under this occupation. Yes, the doors of schools are open, but majority cannot go because of this problems that they are facing, because of insecurity, because of domination of these powerful fundamentalist commanders in different provinces. They don't feel secure to go there. Or even they sometimes use burqa as a sign of, liberation, which is, we think that it's quite symbolic sign. It can't be considered as the whole, you know, problem of the Afghan women. Even today, they are not forced to wear the burqa, but they prefer to wear the burqa due to insecurity. Also, the presence of 67, you know, women inside the parliament is considered as one of the signs of the liberation of women, which we think that we should see who these women are. And I don't say all, but majority of them are deeply, you know, have a relationship with the fundamentalist groups, or they are completely silent. They do not use the their positions to represent, to bring the voice of the sorrowful women of Afghanistan inside parliament. They are not defending the women of Afghanistan inside the parliament. Unfortunately, they are not like Malala Joya, for example. Malala Joya is one of the brave voices, I can say, inside the parliament of Afghanistan, who brought the voice of the voiceless people inside the parliament, and who was quite, I can say, she's the heroine of Afghanistan today for all the people inside the country, because she was the first voice inside the parliament. And the rest of the women are like, in some way, they are in compromise with the government or with the Northern Alliance groups, or they're silent towards the tragedy of the majority of the women in different provinces. So we see that we have a very long way to achieve liberation in women's rights. And we strongly believe, Rawat strongly believe, that as long as fundamentalists have domination, and they have power, and they have the support of, for example, Northern Alliance groups have the support of United States. As long as war criminals like Abdullah is allowed to candidate himself for the presidential election, as long as they have key positions in the governments, we cannot talk about women's rights, and we cannot expect any positive, radical, drastic change in the women's situation.
And I think when we talk about women's rights, women's liberation, it's intrinsically connected to national liberation,
exactly,
and self-determination.
Yeah.
So if you had 5-10 minutes to speak with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who has taken on this, this supposed fight for women's liberation in Afghanistan as her own, just as Laura Bush did during the previous administration. If you had 5-10 minutes with her and President Obama, what would you tell them about what the women of Afghanistan really need?
We have to tell them that they should not deceive the world. They should not deceive themselves. They should not deceive our people by using this beautiful words of democracy and women's rights. I think it's quite offensive. It's a quite painful insult towards our women that they are trying to justify their occupation by using the women's rights and by using the name of the sorrowful women in Afghanistan. But at the same time, we see that they are compromising, they are supporting, they are empowering Northern Alliance fundamentalist groups who are responsible for the rape of our children, for the rape of our grandmothers. They are responsible for killing thousands of civilians only in Kabul. About 80,000 of civilians were killed by them in 1992 till 1994, for looting, for abduction, for kidnapping, for many kind of horrific atrocities and inhuman crimes committed by them. So today we think instead of using these words that they use in the past 8 years, and I think it's quite now clear for everyone, it's not of any more useful slogans for United States. Instead of that, they should honestly change their policies radically, and they should empower the democratic forces in order to establish a real democratic Afghanistan government in Afghanistan. And also they should stop supporting these rapists, these war criminals of Northern Alliance fundamentalists, and they should disempower these war criminals from three organs of the government. They should disarm the private armies of fundamentalist groups from different provinces. Instead of throwing more troops, instead of waging more war, more occupation, which will just bring more miseries and pain and plight for our nation, for our poor majority population, they should change their policy, their strategy in Afghanistan in order to stop supporting fundamentalist groups and start supporting democratic voices in Afghanistan. That's the only way, the only solution for Afghanistan, not throwing more troops.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.